This is edition number 1988 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 10th of October 2025. And a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. We especially welcome new listener Janet Davenport of Overstrand. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 7:15 in the morning and sets at around 6 o'clock in the evening. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 9th of October. I am Judith Elliott-Hunter and my fellow readers are...
John Hoyle.
Jill Mellows.
And Claire Hill.
The magazine supplement, which includes Shakespeare's Mistakes, An Actress's Swimming Success, An Autumn Story, and Coffee Changes Since the Days of Mellow Birds, follows later. But first, the council unveils plans to cut bills for taking kids to school, a woman died trying to save her husband, seafront building needs repairs worth £367,000. However, we lead with dog walkers clash with mountain bikers in the Battle of Bacton Wood. Amid tall pines and venerable oaks of Bacton Wood, a battle is afoot. Two sides have been skirmishing over territory, wielding shovels and carrying out acts of sabotage. Peacekeepers have been drafted in to try and find a resolution, but tensions remain high and tempers are flaring. On the one side are young mountain bikers, drawn to the area by its rugged paths and slopes. On the other are dog walkers who enjoy letting their pets exercise along the same routes through the woodland. Sparks have been flying between the two groups, with dog walkers saying the bikers are damaging the beauty spot by making jumps and obstacles and are rushing past them at dangerous speeds. The bikers say they are deprived of facilities elsewhere and should be allowed to use the routes. They have hit back by criticising the dog walkers for not picking up mess and letting their pets roam out of control. Tensions deepened after the bikers began taking shovels to the woods so they could dig out pits to create bigger jumps. They also began dragging logs onto the paths to create obstacles for them to jump over. However, the dog walkers soon responded. They began taking their own shovels to knock the jumps down. They also complained to Forestry England, which manages the 276-acre woodland. Officials have sided with the dog walkers, saying the logs and jumps could pose a danger to both unsuspecting cyclists and walkers. They have installed signs saying they will be removing unauthorised trails and features. One dog walker said, "They were coming down a hill and were going so fast, and my dog was running a little way behind, so they didn't see her. They'd have killed her if they'd hit her." Another added, "There are places in the woods we won't walk now because of how many bicycles are frequenting them." Another added, "I don't see any need for it. They are taking shovels and spades and doing whatever they want. At the end of the day, it's not a leisure centre. I mean, we ride motorbikes and shoot, and we don't do that down here. You have to travel to proper places that are designed to see these sports." But another said, "It's sad. I've got no problem with it. If you don't like that area and you don't like the kids playing, go somewhere else." And the bikers have criticised Forestry England for taking sides with the dog walkers. Tom Hill, owner of Dr. Wheelgood, a bicycle shop in nearby North Walsham, said, "There's a level of intolerance when someone wags a finger and says, 'You shouldn't do that.' It's a minority of the kids who ride their bikes irresponsibly. These kids need a place to vent, a place to get outside. What better way to spend your after-school time and oxygenate your blood than go biking?" Some dog walkers let their dogs roam and disturb wildlife and let them leave mess and put dog poo bags into trees so they look like Christmas baubles. There are two sides to everything. I think Forestry England needs to have a rethink. A spokesman for Forestry England added, "We don't want to spoil young cyclists' fun. It's great that parents support their children to play outside on their bikes. It's more of a health and safety concern if one of them or a walker injures themselves."
Councillors have unveiled plans to reduce the huge cost to the taxpayer of ferrying children to and from school. The Conservative administration at Norfolk County Council needs to make cuts and savings to balance the books and needs to bring down the £62 million bill for school transport. The council has a statutory duty to provide free travel to their nearest suitable school for eligible children aged 5 to 16, so has to pay for taxis, buses and minibuses. The bulk of that bill, more than £40 million, is to get children with special educational needs and disabilities to schools best placed to cater for their needs, which can mean costly taxi rides far from their homes. Norfolk has a higher proportion of children getting extra support for special educational needs than almost anywhere else in the country, so the cost pressures on County Hall are significant. County Hall leaders have just unveiled £35 million worth of cuts and savings to help plug their £42 million budget gap, which includes proposals to reduce the school transport bill. The council says that it can cut about £750,000 through a number of measures, including reviewing contracts with transport companies and encouraging students deemed able to travel independently to do so. The proposals also include cutting millions from the authority's social care spend, such as focusing on prevention so people do not end up needing costly residential care. Andrew Jamieson, deputy leader of the council and cabinet member for finance, said, "We're prioritising person-centred approaches in adult social care and smarter solutions in school transport. These proposals aim to protect services for vulnerable residents while ensuring value for money. These proposals are not just about cost-cutting. We're investing in how the council delivers local services." The council's budget planning is predicated on a 3% increase in its share of council tax, including a 1% adult social care precept, but has not ruled out a 5% hike, the maximum increase possible without triggering a referendum. Mr. Jamieson said, "We want to minimise the burden on Norfolk taxpayers, and that means keeping rates as low as practically possible. The government has consistently indicated that they expect councils to set council tax to the maximum allowed. Therefore, the financial settlement we receive from the government in December will ultimately dictate where we can set council tax in Norfolk." Brian Watkins, leader of the opposition Liberal Democrat group, said, "The county council is clearly still in very choppy financial waters as we move towards probable local government reorganisation during the next few years. The council must give far more emphasis on preventative approaches to adult social care, and it has to get to grips with the exorbitant costs of school transport. Whilst government expectations are that councils will hike up council tax by 5% again next year, we have to recognise that we still have a cost of living crisis, with many people continuing to face tough choices about making ends meet." Steve Morphew, leader of the Labour group at County Hall, said the Conservatives had underfunded Norfolk for 14 years, but that the decline in services could have been mitigated by changes Labour had pressed for. He said, "The sooner this council is replaced, the better, so we can bring in structures that genuinely reflect local people's needs and value for money, rather than the annual round of fantasy finance this Conservative administration inflicts on Norfolk. The council's cabinet will discuss the proposals next week, with the ultimate decision on the budget to be taken by full council next February."
A woman was killed after an electric heater used to keep her husband warm set fire to bedding and triggered a blaze that tore through their 17th century thatched cottage. Maria Woolner, 86, was asleep in an upstairs room at the property in Woolcot when the fire broke out and is thought to have gone to help her husband, Roy, when she was overcome by the flames. An inquest into her death was told that Mr. Woolner had been sleeping in a downstairs room because he suffered from Alzheimer's and it was safer for him not to use stairs. Rescuers found him collapsed near a back door in the kitchen where he had been trying to flee the property. He was taken to hospital but later recovered. The couple had lived at the property, the old manor house, for 8 years, but had been trying for 2 years to sell it. It had been on the market for £400,000 and they had recently accepted an offer and were preparing to move to a more manageable bungalow in North Walsham. The inquest was told that the fire at the house, said to have been a holiday home for Prince Frederick Duleep Singh, the son of a 19th century Maharaja, broke out shortly after 4 a.m. on Saturday, April the 19th. The alarm was raised by a neighbour who spotted a glow coming from the property. He dialed 999 and fire crews from Stalham, Munsley and North Walsham were on the scene on Coast Road within 30 minutes. In a statement to Norfolk Coroner's Court, police officer Eleanor Moore described how Mr. and Mrs. Woolner had been removed from the building by firefighters and were being given first aid when she arrived. After a few minutes, the smoke from the building was getting overwhelming and making it very difficult to see and breathe, she added. Soon after, the pair were both taken to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital. Mrs. Woolner, a retired carer who had severe burns covering 25% of her body, was then transferred to a specialist burns unit at Broomfield Hospital in Chelmsford, Essex, where she died later that afternoon. Mr. Woolner recovered from his injuries and later went to live in a care home in Beauthorpe. He died last month. The couple's dog, Pip, also survived the fire and has since been rehomed. A neighbour said that before Mrs. Woolner died, she was able to speak with her husband and reassure him that she did not hold him responsible for the fire. The neighbour, who did not wish to be named, said he had been to his care home to visit Mr. Woolner, who believed the heater was to blame. He told me it was an accident, but he felt to blame, the neighbour said. He more or less said to me that he set fire to the room by mistake. He said he'd spoken to her and she forgave him. Fire investigators were able to pinpoint the origin of the fire as the single-storey ground floor garden room which was used as bedroom for Mr. Woolner, who had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's in January. In her report, Sarah Palmer from Norfolk Fire and Rescue said, "The burn patterns support the fire developed within this room and spread externally to the thatched roof above. The burning thatch above in turn collapsed into and then affected the first floor, bedroom one." She said the heater was placed too near Mr. Woolner's bed and had ignited the covers. She added, "It is thought Mr. Woolner may have been alerted by a fire alarm and sought to leave the house, but was overcome by the toxic fumes and collapsed near the back exit in the kitchen, where he was found unconscious. It is thought Mrs. Woolner, who had been sleeping upstairs, was also woken by the fire alarm and likely went to look for her husband, unaware that he had already left the room. She was caught out by the heat and developing fire, sustaining substantial burns. There was also the suggestion she may have been roused before Mr. Woolner, gone to usher him out of the bedroom and then returned to put the fire out, but was overcome by the fire. The nature and extent of her burns suggest she may have attempted to tackle the fire and at this point was caught in a flashover, a rapid and intense phase of fire development where the entire room becomes fully involved." When the fire crews found her, Mrs. Woolner was unconscious behind a sofa in the sitting room. Recording an accidental death, Assistant Coroner Joanna Thompson agreed with the findings of the fire officer's report. The Woolner's granddaughter paid a heartfelt tribute to the couple at the inquest. Sasha Tallboys told the court that her grandmother had moved from Spain to England at the age of 19, where she met Mr. Woolner soon after. She said, "Grandpa worked in the security sector. My nanny had always been a carer. This is why she was so adamant she wanted to look after my grandpa. So she spent most of her life helping others. It was something she felt incredibly passionate about." The couple married quickly and went on to have three children. They spent most of their life in Welling Green, Hertfordshire, and then Letchworth Garden City, before retiring to Norfolk, first Trimmingham and then Walcott, where they lived for 8 years. The couple's Walcott home is said to have once been used to accommodate pilgrims who visited Bacton Abbey, and it is rumoured that an underground tunnel was built linking the two places.
A landmark seafront building is requiring new repairs that will cost more than £367,000 to complete. North Norfolk District Council's Liberal Democrat cabinet members have agreed to approve the work to bring the Rocket House in Cromer fully back into use. The authority already agreed to a revamp programme totalling about £1 million, and this latest project should fall within this budget. Investigations discovered further work was needed to address damp issues caused by bad drainage from the public toilets following initial refurbishment work. However, experts no longer think it is necessary to pursue a larger scale tanking operation on the ground floor. Completing the project is necessary for the RNLI's Henry Blogg Museum to reopen after it was forced to shut due to the problems with damp, which were causing staff to feel unwell. The Rocket House Cafe is currently open, having undergone refurbishment works. Tim Adams, leader of NNDC, said, "The Rocket House plays a hugely important part in the vitality of Cromer's seafront and continues to be a great resource for the town. I'm delighted we are now able to move forward with the necessary work to invest in the building and safeguard its future. The works and a new lease, which we are discussing with the RNLI, will enable the return of the Henry Blogg Museum to its home in Cromer, along with the H.F. Bailey, Henry's lifeboat, which so many people helped to preserve." RNLI Head of Region Rebecca Felton added, "The museum helps preserve the memory of Henry Blogg and all the people of Cromer who gave so much to saving lives at sea. We are pleased to be able to enter discussions on the new lease." The Rocket House has become a contentious issue among North Norfolk councillors, with some questioning the costly repairs needed to bring it back into action. NNDC officers say the work programme should still fall within the initial budget of £1 million overall, but the council may need to commit to more money later as the work progresses.
The family of a man who has been missing for 4 weeks are living in hope that he will be found. Ross Abbs vanished from Milton Keynes on September the 10th, and officers believe he may have driven to Haysborough. The search has now entered its fourth week, but Stephen Williams, Mr. Abbs' stepson, said that the family remains hopeful that he will come home. "We live in hope that he is going to turn up somewhere, but there's been little sign of him," Mr. Williams said. "The whole family is devastated and just feeling low, but we're all trying to rally round my mum at the moment. He is a brilliant carer for my mum, so we are all just utterly confused as to why he would just leave and leave no note for his family." The 77-year-old is a carer for his wife Wendy, who was diagnosed with a brain tumour 13 years ago and was described as being a model carer by Mr. Williams. "Mr. Abbs loves Norfolk and visited Haysborough with his wife for a holiday around 7 years ago. The discovery of my mum's brain tumour really cut any hope of going abroad, so they decided on a Norfolk holiday and he loved it," the 56-year-old said. "He grew up in Norfolk and in his will he requested his ashes be scattered in wells next the sea. A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary has confirmed that searches remain ongoing for Mr. Abbs. Police have put out 2 appeals, but there remains no sign of him. I met him when I was 4 or 5 years of age, Mr. Williams added. He was very supportive of me, and I always just thought of him as my second dad. He's a great stepfather and great-grandfather to my children. The way he invests time in young people and helps them is admirable. I just really hope someone comes forward with some information about him. Anyone who has seen Mr. Abbs or knows of his whereabouts should contact Norfolk Constabulary on 101, quoting reference 177 of September the 11th.
New plans for a £350,000 bus scheme revamp in a Norfolk town have been unveiled after an angry backlash to previous proposals. Norfolk County Council has come up with new vision to transform station approach in Sheringham to create a travel hub for the town. Council officials say the new plans for the space outside the North Norfolk Railway Station have been shaped by the community after public consultation earlier this year. Previous plans had proved unpopular, with critics saying the scheme was out of character with the surroundings. One dubbed it a plastic monstrosity. The council said the updated plan had taken on board the criticism and the results of the consultation. Changes include a different style of bus shelter to better blend in with the surroundings, including the Heritage Railway Station. Artist Colin Seal, who created the mural on the current shelter, will be working with schoolchildren to produce new artwork for the new shelter. The revised plans also include extra green space with Sheringham in bloom due to oversee the planting and maintenance. Sheringham Museum will also develop an interactive timeline of the town's history to be etched into the paving. The hub will include extra seating, real-time passenger information, an area for storing or repairing bicycles, a water refill station, and signs to help visitors find their way around Sheringham. Graham Plant, Conservative-run County Hall's Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said the public consultation had been invaluable. He said, "It helped us make some really important changes to the original design and create a space which we hope everyone who lives, works and visits Sheringham can be proud of and enjoy. We changed the design of the scheme to ensure it's in keeping with the historic surroundings and sought to maximise green spaces to ensure biodiversity is maintained." Mr. Plant added, "I appreciate that some people would like to see money spent on other things, but our bus service improvement grant can only be used for improvements to our bus infrastructure. Otherwise, we lose it. A start date has yet to be announced."
A grandfather who took his own life just weeks after a referral for mental health support was downgraded from urgent to routine. Julian Wade from Bacton was found dead at his home in May this year at the age of 68. An inquest into his death held on Monday heard that Mr. Wade had a history of mental health struggles for which he was seeking support. In the final weeks of his life, he had begun therapy through the private sector, but was discharged from this after missing 2 consecutive sessions. On May the 8th, he then visited his GP, who made an urgent referral for him to the crisis team at the Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust. Under urgent referrals, patients are then required to be assessed within 72 hours. However, the court heard the referral was downgraded to a routine one, which comes with a 28-day response period. In a statement read to the court, Melanie Ladd, a clinical lead at NSFT, said, "The referral referred to him as being a bit suicidal. The referral was discussed at a multidisciplinary team meeting on May the 12th, and it was felt it would be more suitable for a routine referral. On Thursday, May the 30th, he was found at his home, having taken a deliberate act to end his own life. Yvonne Blake, area coroner for Norfolk, gave a conclusion of suicide. She says, "It appeared that his referral was downgraded due to a lack of detail to meet the urgent criteria. Referrals like this are often downgraded." Meanwhile, the court heard that Mr. Wade had spent 30 years working for Sky Television, which saw him split his time between Norfolk and London. In a statement, his son told the court, "My dad was a kind, gentle and generous man, very easy to get on with. He was loved and was particularly valued at his work, and I miss him greatly."
A primary school has decided to push ahead with plans to shorten teaching hours for pupils. The original proposals put forward by Buxton Primary School in March were intended to address the continued and increased financial pressure on the education centre. The new timetable, which has now been given the go-ahead by the local authority after months of debate, will see the school open from 8:10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Fridays. The school day would continue to start at 8:10 a.m. and finish at 3:05 p.m. for the rest of the week. An after-school club will be held for pupils on Friday from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m, costing £4 an hour. Following a consultation held on September the 11th, which considered an alternative option of reducing school hours during the week rather than just the Friday, the local authority and the school agreed to the original proposal. The decision has now been revealed to parents and all relevant stakeholders. Jules Stops, head teacher of the school in Aylsham Road, said, "The governing body has confirmed its decision to adjust the school timetable in line with its original proposal on a year-long trial basis from January 2026. We have remained engaged with the local authority and unions throughout this process and will continue dialogue during the trial period and reviews. Similar models have already been successfully adopted by LA maintained and trust schools across England." One parent, who preferred to remain anonymous, said, "It feels like it was just a box-ticking exercise to me. How has it taken this long to come to this decision?" In previous meetings, parents were split on this proposal, with one third in favour of the reduction, a third against it, and the rest unsure. The primary school claims the timetable has been carefully arranged to ensure pupils still receive 32.5 hours of teaching per week, the minimum suggested by non-statutory governmental guidelines. Council leaders hope that the controversial proposal would be avoided, with the warning that the change is not in children's best interests.
Five people have been arrested in connection with a violent attack on a man that has left him in a critical condition in hospital. Officers were called to Cherry Tree Lane in North Walsham at around 6:30 a.m. on Saturday, September the 27th, following reports that a man had been seriously assaulted. The victim, who is in his 20s, was taken to the hospital with serious injuries, where he remains in a critical but stable condition. Three people were arrested and taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning. Billy Galley, 22, of Laundry Loke, North Walsham. Kane Pap Pettit, 19, of Victoria Road in Great Yarmouth. And a 17-year-old boy from Norwich, who cannot be named for legal reasons, were all charged with causing grievous bodily harm with intent. The three suspects all appeared at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court on Monday and pleaded not guilty. They were remanded in custody and are due to appear at Norwich Crown Court on October the 27th. Two further arrests were made on Thursday when a woman aged in her late teens and a man in his 20s were taken for questioning at King's Lynn Police Station, also on suspicion of grievous bodily harm with intent. A police cordon was put in place at the address in Cherry Tree Lane while officers carried out their inquiries.
A warning has been issued after a series of insulation removal scams in Norfolk. Trading Standards issued the notice on Wednesday as temperatures started to drop across the county. A spokesman for Norfolk County Council Trading Standards said, "Over the past year, we've noticed a steep rise in complaints about cold callers offering to remove foam insulation. These companies often call consumers out of the blue, claiming that the insulation that was put in was incorrect and will cause problems with insurance, damp, and future house sales. Often, the original company that installed the insulation will have disappeared and stopped trading, and the new company will offer to come to the rescue and remove it for a price. While spray foam does lead to problems if applied incorrectly or on a property that isn't appropriate, it's important that consumers are aware that these new companies are not always legitimate. Trading Standards have advised people to do their own research before agreeing to any removal works taking place and encourage anyone concerned to seek an independent opinion on whether the works would be necessary."
The owner of an energy company building one of the world's largest wind farms off the coast of East Anglia has unveiled plans to make the UK its number one investment destination. Spanish renewable energy company Iberdrola, which owns Scottish Power, is set to pour around £50 billion, €58 billion, into its global projects by 2028, with more than 65% of the investment coming to the UK and US. The plan, launched in London last Wednesday, will prioritise electricity grids to help deliver a new era for investment. Scottish Power Renewables is currently constructing the £4 billion East Anglia 3 wind farm, 43 miles off the Suffolk coast. Once operational at the end of 2026, the wind farm will be one of the largest in the world, with up to 100 turbines generating enough clean electricity to power more than 1 million homes. "We're the only company in the world that can deliver this opportunity due to our size and scale," Iberdrola's executive chairman, Ignacio Galen, said. "We will invest €58 billion by 2028, two-thirds of which will go to transmission and distribution networks, mainly in the UK and the US."
Police removed a large haul of weapons from a home in a Norfolk village following a dramatic incident which saw the A140 briefly blocked. Armed officers closed off the road through Hevingham during the morning rush hour while several police vehicles went to the property. Eyewitnesses say officers were seen carrying out 20 rifles from the property and putting them in a police van. Officers arrived at the scene at around 6:40 a.m. on Monday in various cars, an SUV and a police van. A spokesman for the force said police were responding to reports about a concern for safety, but did not give any further information. Two ambulances were also sent to the scene, and a man from the property was checked over by paramedics. While some of the weapons appeared to be in cases, others could be seen and seemed to be large hunting-style rifles. An officer said the issue related to a medical matter and that there was no cause for safety concerns. There were no arrests made. The man, who later emerged from the ambulance, offered a thumbs up to the officers before he returned inside to speak to other officers. The A140 was blocked by police until 7:50 a.m.
A family has opened a new equestrian escape where people can bring their horses on holiday. The McCarters, who love horses and have four of their own, have built a new holiday let on their 10-acre plot in East Ruston. Black Horse Barn boasts two bedrooms, an open-plan kitchen, living and dining space, and a patio which looks out over the rolling fields. People are welcome to bring their horses to stay in the fully equipped stables, and there are plenty of nature trails that are perfect for hacking close by. There are also a variety of woodlands and beaches just a short drive away. Paula McCarter said she and her husband George wanted to share their idyllic corner of the county with other people. They also wanted to make it easier for animal owners to take a well-earned break from everyday life. Mrs. McCarter explained the development of Black Horse Barn has been 100% a family effort, as her sons Harry and Archie helped to build and decorate the cottage, and their partners Marnie and Abby will help run it. "We all love our horses. I have been riding since I was 3," she said. "My dad bought a little Shetland pony home and just popped me down on it. The space we have here is very, very natural. We have 10 acres of land and we have planted 100 trees since 2007, so it is really nice and tranquil. We can't wait for people to come and see it."
A cafe by the coast has been named the best to visit with a dog in the UK. The lifestyle website Dog Friendly Retreats completed a study to find the best places for dog walkers to stop off for a coffee and a bite to eat. The researchers looked at everything from dedicated dog menus and water bowls to parking options and proximity to scenic walks. And Wells Next to Sea Beach Cafe came out on top. As the name suggests, it sits right beside Wells Beach, and the Norfolk Coast Path is close by. It has features such as a quirky bark-up bar, water station, and a paw washing point. There is a dedicated pooch menu packed with sausages and biscuits, and there are wood burners for the colder months. Josh Williams, founder of Dog Friendly Retreats, said, "East of England, and Norfolk in particular, is a dream destination for dog owners. Cafes like Wells Next to Sea Beach Cafe show how hospitality is evolving, with features designed specifically for pets as well as their owners. It makes the region a true standout for canine-friendly travel."
A seaside cafe that closed after a row over loos is being converted into two flats. Number 17 on Beach Road in Munsley stopped trading in June 2024 after the owners were told they needed to install a customer toilet, even though there was a public convenience across the road. A planning application to change the use of the ground floor to two flats has now been approved by planners at North Norfolk District Council. The building dates from the 1960s and occupies a visually prominent position along Beach Road. It was originally built as part of a block of 4 commercial units. Munsley Parish Council had objected to the proposal, stating that the site is in the coastal erosion zone and at risk within the next 100 years. The latest application follows the earlier conversion of the first floor into two flats and a separate ground floor unit next door, which is also set to become a flat. It is understood that building works have already commenced on the site.
A lifestyle store that sells everything from candles and soap to jewellery is expanding into larger premises. Dolly's Home and Gifts launched in Vicarage Street, North Walsham last December, but founder Helen Richardson is already growing the business. She has secured a bigger store in the town's marketplace and is busy completing a refurbishment with the aim of opening in the next couple of weeks. The new Dolly's will continue to sell items from a range of brands including Lisa Angel and Orchard Toys. But there will also be some new additions as her daughter's floristry business will be based there. Mrs. Richardson, 47, said, "It's all happened so quickly, but things were going so well that we thought we would take the opportunity while we could. I love having the shop and meeting all the people who come in. I've always had customer-facing jobs and I keep a chair in front of the counter so people can stop for a chat. Some people come in and have no idea what they're looking for, so I can recommend gifts for them to buy. It's lovely to be a part of."
An office manager entrusted with cashing up at a popular seafront fish and chip shop is accused of stealing almost £25,000. Daniel Apps, 43, is alleged to have pocketed the takings at the award-winning number one Cromer that he was meant to be banking. Norwich Magistrates Court was told that he had been employed as a manager from 2021 to 2023, which allowed him access to the business safe and cash and responsibility for depositing money in the bank. Prosecutors alleged that following his departure from the job, a review had been conducted, and takings between October the 27th, 2023 and November the 30th were £25,237, of which only £248 had been paid into the bank. Number One Cromer is run by directors Spencer Gray, Galton Blackiston, who also runs the Michelin-starred Morstan Hall near Holt, and Tracy Blackiston. Frequently attracting long queues from diners, the successful restaurant and takeaway, which offers stunning views over the beach and pier, was recently named among the top 10 fish and chip shops in the UK. It is now in the running for Restaurant of the Year in the National Fish and Chip Awards 2026. Apps of West Street in Cromer pleaded not guilty to theft by employee and fraud by false representation. He also denied a third charge of criminal damage relating to The Perch, an apartment owned by Number One Cromer between June and December 2023. Magistrates were told the offences carried a starting point of 2 years in prison and were not suitable for summary trial. They committed the case to Norwich Crown Court with a plea and trial preparation hearing on November the 4th. Apps was given unconditional bail. Number One Cromer, despite opening in 2013, can trace its origins back to Spencer Gray's family heritage in fishing since 1842 and followed on from him establishing Cromer Shellfish at just 17 years old.
A legal battle over a council's controversial plans for a new Norfolk recycling centre is to return to the courtroom after the case was referred to the Court of Appeal. Martin and Oliver Reed, who run Hilltop Outdoor Centre in North Norfolk, have been granted another chance to convince a judge that Norfolk County Council acted unlawfully over plans for a replacement Sheringham tip. The pair's legal experts had argued in London's Royal Court of Justice that the council failed to show proper and lawful processes when deciding and agreeing the move of Sheringham Recycling Centre from its site off Holt Road in Beeston Regis to fields opposite. Following hearings earlier this year, High Court Judge Mrs. Justice Leven dismissed all the grounds which Hilltop's barristers argued. But the Reeds applied for permission to appeal that decision, and the matter will now go to the Court of Appeal, the highest senior court in England and Wales. Lord Justice Newey, after considering the submission by lawyers for the Reeds, agreed to send the matter to the Court of Appeal, stating that the arguments advanced by the appellant have sufficient substance for the appeal to have a real prospect of success. The Reeds say that Conservative-run County Hall, which was the applicant and the decision-maker on the scheme, did not have properly considered alternative sites during the selection process. They argued that officers failed to present full information to the Planning Committee, which approved the plans in May last year. The Reeds said there were at least three viable alternatives to the one the council decided on, including at East Beckham Quarry and Stonehill Way in Cromer. The selected site, next to Hilltop, is in a field in a national landscape, a status previously described as areas of outstanding natural beauty, which the council acknowledges is against its own policy. But despite that, officers recommended approval, saying great weight needed to be attached to the need for essential infrastructure, and councillors granted permission. A date for the appeal has yet to be fixed, but the Court of Appeal has to have considered it by October next year.
Shell has said it will support talks between a trade union and a contracting company after workers at its Bacton gas terminal site voted to strike in a row over pay. Altrad workers, who provide maintenance and critical support services at the North Norfolk gas plant, unanimously voted to back strike action last month. The French-based firm offered staff on the Shell site a one-time 4% pay rise, which the GMB union said fell short of the two-year deal of 11.3% and 5.5% proposed under the National Agreement for the Engineering Construction Industry, NAECI. All participating members backed strike action on a 96% turnout. Shell has said it will support talks between the two parties. A spokesman said, "We support constructive dialogue between the union and contracting company to reach a mutually agreed resolution." Around a third of the UK's gas supply is processed at Bacton Gas Terminal, but the union has warned that strike action would bring work on this site to a standstill. Workers are said to be furious that Altrad staff at another site are being paid more to do the same work after receiving a pay increase following another recent GMB union dispute. Staff at the Bacton site, who do identical work, including scaffolding, painting, and thermal insulation, are now seeking the same resolution. Paul Block, GMB regional organiser, said, "GMB representatives have worked hard to try and negotiate a resolution to this dispute. This mandate shows the strength of feeling among our membership. It is in the best interests of Altrad management to reflect on this result, listen to our members, and come back to the table urgently. Failure to resolve this dispute will result in strike action, which would bring work on this site to a standstill." Altrad has not publicly commented on the proposed strike action.
The RNLI has confirmed it will keep its lifeboat station in a seaside resort in operation after its sudden closure sparked speculation about its future. North Norfolk District Council and the RNLI have agreed to secure a new long-term lease for its site on Sheringham Seafront. Cabinet members agreed on a 25-year agreement for the station building, which is in need of substantial repairs. The site was forced to close at the start of the year after the structure became unsafe. There are also risks of the cliffs behind it eroding. Its sudden shuttering triggered concerns that the RNLI's presence in town could be in doubt. But the decision to enter into a new lease confirms the charity's commitment to keeping its presence in the town. Liz Withington, Cabinet Member for Community, Leisure and Outreach, said, "The RNLI has always been woven into Sheringham's story. From generations of local fishermen whose livelihoods depended on safety at sea, to the thousands of visitors who come to enjoy our coast each year. This new long-term lease is more than a practical step. It is a recognition of the vital role the lifeboat station and its volunteers continue to play in the life of our town. The RNLI's presence is part of our social history and part of our community's future, protecting both residents and visitors. By enabling the station to be rebuilt, we are safeguarding that proud tradition of bravery and service for the next 25 years and beyond." Rebecca Felton, head of the regional RNLI branch, said, "We are pleased that the council has agreed to extend our lease at the Sheringham RNLI station by 25 years. This will enable us to carry out the necessary building works to ensure the long-term viability of the station in the area. We would like to thank North Norfolk District Council for showing their ongoing support for the work of the RNLI in the area."
You are listening to edition number 1988 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 10th of October 2025. We have articles about a classic car festival, a magical livestock education experience, recognition for our heritage railway, and a Wroxham mockumentary up for an award, and the Mardler magazine supplement, There are no letters to the editor this week, but we have one obituary and details of some What's On events.
David Francis Wells sadly passed away at the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital on September the 21st, 2025, aged 81 years. Beloved partner of the late James Moss, son of the late Harry and Nora Wells, brother of the late Tom Wells and the late Anne Calloway, uncle of Peter and Patrick Calloway. Funeral service to be held on Wednesday, October the 22nd, 2025, at 1:45 p.m. in the Sheringham Salvation Army Citadel, followed by a committal at Cromer Crematorium for close friends and family. No flowers, please, but donations to the RSPB can be sent care of Blythe & Sons Limited, 4 Creamer Street, Sheringham, NR26 8DZ.
Forthcoming events include on Sunday, the 12th of October, Native to Norfolk Reefham Market at the Station Cafe, Reefham, 9:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Massingham Together Fete at Village Hall and Jubilee Field, Station Road, Great Massingham, raising funds for a new inclusive playground, 12 p.m. to 4 p.m.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. A sponsored swim, a Norfolk author's autumn book, and how coffee has moved on. But first, Shakespeare wouldn't pass a GCSE in natural history. In the second act of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Titania is sung to sleep by her fairies. Their lullaby begins, "You spotted snakes with double tongue, thorny hedgehogs be not seen, newts and blindworms do no wrong, come not near our fairy queen." Titania is heading into a very hard night. She is, after all, on the point of being drugged by her estranged husband, leading to an infatuation with a donkey. However, and far be it from me to question the bard, I struggle with Shakespeare's naked anti-wildlife propaganda. Granted, in his day, spotted snakes, aka adders, the UK's only genuinely venomous terrestrial vertebrates, would have been widespread and abundant across vast tracts of common land and field edges. Today, they cling on as an isolated population on fragments of remnant habitat. The likelihood of having an unfortunate encounter with a spotted snake, while still infinitesimally small, was hugely greater in the 1500s and 1600s. But were you a sleeping fairy, you would simply never have fallen foul of an adder. Adders strike humans and fairies exceptionally rarely and only in self-defence. In a lifetime of watching wildlife, I have known only 2 people bitten by adders. The first was a school friend who stupidly picked up an infant adder while on a cross-country run. Under the circumstances, the terrified viper can hardly be blamed for biting him. The second incident was likewise self-preservation. An ecologist friend, undertaking a reptile survey, mistakenly placed his hand a mere inch from a resting adder as he turned a tin sheet placed as a basking spot for reptiles and amphibians. Finding itself so close to a gigantic predator, the startled adder deployed some precious venom to save its gorgeously patterned skin. My friend spent a night in hospital with one hand worthy of Shrek, but suffered no long-term consequences. Adders want nothing more than to be left alone. As for newts and blindworms, Shakespeare is, as I believe he himself once said, bang out of order. Newts are beautiful, peaceable creatures of ponds and pools. Indeed, Shakespeare could learn a thing or two from P.G. Woodhouse's Gussie Finknottle, who, though mocked by Bertie Wooster for his passion, displays a charming devotion to newts and their habits. Newts mean no harm, neither to humans nor to fairies. Shakespeare's blind worms are what we would now term slow worms. They are not blind, nor indeed worms, nor are they remotely interested in harming fairy queens. Were a slow worm to cross paths with a slumbering fairy, it would most likely be hunting for slugs, worms, or other invertebrates. A slow worm would pass a fairy by without so much as a flicker of its adorable blackish tongue. I've recently had the privilege of contributing to planning for the forthcoming GCSE in Natural History, and let me tell you, from this position of lofty authority, that A Midsummer Night's Dream might do very well as English literature coursework, but natural history, Shakespeare would likely fail. And here's the rub. Thank you, Shakespeare, for that bon mot. The playwright's greatest offence must surely be his casual hedgehog bashing. Listen up, Shakey. If you pick a fight with the prickly people, then you pick a fight with me. Hedgehogs, I ask you, those loveliest and most helpful of neighbours. What have hedgehogs done to you, Will? I very much doubt they ever attacked, cursed, or even startled your fairies. This said, I was once bitten on the ankle by a long-eared hedgehog in a ger tent in the Mongolian Gobi Altai. The poor animal had been detained by local people the night before and had taken refuge in the skirts of the tent and had just been enraged by a remarkably loud folk singer. But I digress. Were Shakespeare alive today, I like to think he would twig how wrong he once was about hedgehogs, adders and newts. Being a sagacious sort, he would probably be a member of the London Wildlife Trust, perhaps, honouring his Stratford roots, a member of Warwickshire's Wildlife Trust too. Certainly, he would be a passionate advocate for hedgehogs. For they, and spotted snakes and blindworms, have declined catastrophically since Shakespeare's day and are still in steep decline today. While these species lead very different lives, it is irrefutably our human stranglehold on nature that has driven all of them from so many erstwhile haunts and so reduced their populations. What these species need is simple. They need habitat, plenty of good habitat, which is undisturbed by humans and by our dogs, cats, pheasants and other familiars, and untainted by the innumerable toxins with which we lathe both land and water. This habitat must offer plenty of natural food, sites for raising young, and in the case of hedgehogs, slow worms and adders, somewhere safe to hibernate each winter. Crucially, these animals also need their habitats to be connected through living corridors across the landscape, for them to mingle genes, disperse, migrate and adapt to climate change. Shakespeare made reference to adults, slow worms, newts and hedgehogs because these animals were relevant to his audience, known to them, loved by them, even in central London. Wonderful though they are, these are not mere interesting creatures. They are co-citizens of these islands, as native here as we are. They and their habitats should be known to everyone today, just as they were in Shakespeare's life. It is our job at the Norfolk Wildlife Trust, but just as much the job of everyone in society, to reimagine and recreate a landscape full of healthy habitat in which all wild species can thrive again, can spread and multiply. All wild species, including humans and fairies, I suppose. That article by Nick Aitchison appeared in the October 2025 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, making waves. Everything hurts apart from my heart, which feels full of love and gratitude, says actor Maggie Service, beaming over Zoom. I'm really proud of us. She's clearly still buzzing from completing a charity challenge a few days earlier with her friend, Harry Potter and Blackadder star Miranda Richardson. The pair swam 4 kilometres along the Norfolk coast in an impressive 1 hour, 35 minutes in some choppy conditions on a wild swim mission to raise vital funds for WWF's work to protect and restore nature. The location for the swim, from Blakeney Harbour across the estuary to Pynchon's Creek on Blakeney Point, was chosen to spotlight the urgent need to protect the UK's precious coastal ecosystems, rivers and wetlands, and to highlight the benefits of connecting with nature for both well-being and the planet. To date, the duo have raised around £21,000. Blakeney is part of what they call a Wholescape programme, which is about working with lots of different charities within the community, trying to find answers to climate crises with nature-based solutions that help the wildlife's habitat, but also our habitat too, explains Maggie, who's appeared in TV shows including Good Omens, Doctor Who and Quiz. I've never been to Norfolk before. It's a beautiful part of the world. It also tied in with WWF's Prescription for Nature campaign, which both Maggie and Miranda are passionate advocates for. It's not a wishy-washy thing. There's scientific proof that the smell of the soil can make our brains feel happier, and looking at green and blue can have a big effect on us, says Maggie. It's a stressful life, isn't it? And terrible things happen that aren't in our control, and it's very difficult to know how to respond to that sometimes. But if you can give yourself just a little chunk of the day, every day, it doesn't need to be more than 20 minutes, just to sit in the garden, study a leaf, listen to birdsong, open a window, go for a walk, be aware of just you being part of the world. I think it makes the world a better place when we don't think humans are the most important things on the planet. The day of the swim started at 4 a.m. with Maggie and Miranda fueling themselves with porridge. Did Maggie ever have a moment when she wondered how she got herself into that situation? Our friendship started on Good Omens, talking about nature and swimming and interior design and vodka martinis, she says. Miranda has been a WWF ambassador for decades. She'd been looking for a project and got in touch and asked me if I'd be up for such a thing, and I, possibly stupidly, said yes to it. And Miranda said, I thought she was the right one to ask. Saying yes was, of course, the easy part. Months of grueling training to prepare followed. We're enthusiastic swimmers, but we're not in any way athletic, so it felt like it was going to be fun. And then we realised it was going to be really hard work, and possibly a bit of fun too, says Maggie. I've swum sort of forever. My dad's up in the Highlands, and it just feels rude to not swim in the loch every day when I'm there. And then, when I moved to London, I was trying to find ways to feel like I wasn't in London sometimes. I started swimming at Brockwell Lido all year round, and now I've built up the acclimatisation. I just want to chuck myself in any body of water, loch, sea, bucket. It gets addictive. I think that some people think that it's about conquering it, but for me, it's about being just part of the landscape. That's why it tied in so well with WWF, because wild swimming is like a magical portal to another universe. You're at eye level with a seal or an otter or a bird, and then you're looking up at these huge mountains. It gives you a new view of the world, and when it's cold, you just feel like a superhero. SwimQuest swimming holidays worked out their route and helped with their training program. The duo were given free training sessions at Forest Hill Indoor Pools, Brockwell Lido and Beckenham Lake, to help them build their technique and endurance, and Finisterre, Wilder Swimming and Orca provided their kit. What I realised is that so much of it is to do with the mind and that brilliant thing that if the mind believes, the body achieves, says Maggie. So just making sure that the mind and body are talking to each other all the time. But we've had all sorts of injuries, and I got COVID for 5 days. I couldn't get out of bed. It's really bonded us and changed our friendship now to team status, which is a really lovely thing. On the day, they set out at 7 a.m. Despite the clear skies and bright sunshine, the westerly wind blowing against the tide created some choppy conditions. I was swimming in place for some time. It really felt like a battle, says Maggie. Miranda said every time her head went underwater, she was silently cursing and did at one point lift my head and have one really loud swear to get it out of my system. But it was great. We both had a kayak and a support boat with us. So Miranda had one of her great friends and I had my lovely dad, who'd come off holiday early to support me. That gave me a right old gee-up in the middle when I was thinking maybe I couldn't do it. I had to really have a word with the mind and just follow the nose of the kayak. Immediately after the swim, Maggie had a hot bath to warm up. Then the pair met up with family and friends for a slap-up lunch, and as they hadn't been drinking alcohol because of their training, Maggie Miranda celebrated with their favourite tipple, dried vodka martini with 3 olives. I'm so proud of us. We're not athletes. We're 2 actors trying to do a nice thing. And I'm so grateful to everybody who's donated and supported us. And the kindness of people in Blakeney, says Maggie. Everyone on our support boats and kayaks had all volunteered their time. I really felt like Norfolk was going, "Go on, girls." That article by Emma Lee was from the Norfolk Magazine October 2025 issue.
And now, falling in love with autumn. Heidi Swain has been a bookworm for as long as she can remember. Growing up in the Cambridgeshire Fens, she recalls loving the long, light summer days because it meant that she could sneak in some extra reading after bedtime without the glow of a lamp giving away that she wasn't in the land of Nod. When I was really tiny, I had this set of Disney books and it was called A Story a Day, and there was spring, summer, autumn and winter. It was written in a diary format with tiny short stories about different Disney characters, and I loved those, she said. I loved Winnie the Pooh as well, and then I moved on to Enid Blyton, and then on to Judy Blume, and then straight on to Gilly Cooper. Quite an eclectic mix of younger years reading there. The author of Rivals and Riders is often cited as an influence by many novelists, and one of the highlights of Heidi's career so far has been meeting Dame Gilly when she was awarded the Romantic Novelists Association's Outstanding Achievement Award in 2018. I thought that if I didn't talk to her, I was always going to regret it, says Heidi. So I told her about when I was a weekly boarder at Swaffham Convent. I had a copy of Riders and we used to read it when the nuns had turned the lights out. That one copy went round all the dorms. She loved the story. Prolific Dame Gilly has had 44 novels published, including her wildly popular Rutshire Chronicles series, starring the caddish Rupert Campbell Black. But Heidi is catching up. Her first novel, The Cherry Tree Cafe, came out in 2015, and her latest, All Wrapped Up, which is out now, is her 21st. She is a Sunday Times bestseller, and her books have now sold 1 million copies in the UK. And in 2023, her book, A Christmas Celebration, was awarded the RNA Popular Romantic Fiction Award. I'm now working on the first draft of book 22, she says. I just don't know how it's happened. Heidi was working in a school as a teaching assistant for pupils with special educational needs, but had always loved writing as well as reading. Approaching a big birthday, she decided that it was high time that she gave writing a proper go. I've got a friend from school who can remember me writing stories, but I didn't share them with anybody. I didn't have the confidence to say, these are the words that I've written down, what do you think? So it was something that I did and kept to myself for years and years. I got to the point where I thought that If I didn't have a go at it properly, I was going to be leaving it really late. So I joined some creative writing classes in Norwich, which were brilliant. I wrote a lot of short stories, and then I thought I would see if I could write a novel, not with the intention of doing anything specific with it, just to see if I could write 100,000 words and get them to hang together. The kids were small, I'd got a family to run, and I would write in the morning before they were up, in my car during my lunch break at school, and when they were in bed. But I loved it, so I carried on. It felt like the longest apprenticeship ever. Heidi had written and edited The Cherry Tree Cafe, and when Books and the City, the digital imprint of publisher Simon & Schuster, did its 2014 24-hour open call for manuscripts, she took a leap of faith. You don't have to have an agent or representation. You put in your manuscript and they have a look at it. Here we are, 22 books later, she says. Setting her feel-good books in three different locations, all inspired by Norfolk, means that she is never short of inspiration. Both her debut novel and her latest are set in the fictional fen town of Winbridge. She also chronicles the goings-on in Nightingale Square in Norwich and Winmouth, a seaside town in North Norfolk, which features elements of some of her favourite places, including Wells, Blakeney and Sheringham. There are also standalone books set in other locations too. Heidi's books come out twice a year, one set in the summer and one at Christmas. But this year, in a departure, All Wrapped Up is set in autumn, her favourite season. A cosy blanket and pumpkin spice latte of a book. It tells the story of Clemmie Bennett, who has spent the last 18 months living a private life renovating Rowan Cottage on the outskirts of Winbridge, following the death of her husband in a tragic accident. She has been anonymously documenting the refurbishment on her Instagram account, at Everything Autumn, and fate intervenes when she meets Lizzie Dixon, owner of the Cherry Tree Cafe, who pulls her into organising the town's first ever autumn festival with local vet Ash and Pixie the dog. Unbelievably, this time last year, I hadn't even imagined this book, she says. I was finishing off the summer book, Best Summer Ever, and I was starting to think about what I could do for the Christmas book, and I'd got a bit of plan in my mind. I'd had so many people say to me at events that they would love me to write an autumn story, but with the publishing schedule, it's quite tricky to change the time when you put a book out. Then, about 3 days before I was going on a writing retreat with four other friends, my editor emailed me and said, she always starts with, you can totally say no to this, but, and she asked how I would feel about writing an autumn story. I just thought, wow, this is my moment. I had to set it in Winbridge with all the beautiful pumpkin fields. And by the end of the retreat on the following Friday, I had the entire book plotted, mapped out, and I was ready to start writing it. The novel was a chance for Heidi to indulge in all her favourite things about autumn in the countryside. Autumn is my favourite season. You've got that mellow warmth. It's cool enough that you've got long sleeves on, but it's not chilly. Coming up with the idea for an autumn festival gave me an excuse to put in so many autumn things. Clemmie loves autumn, but that's definitely me. I really like to do things that connect me with nature in autumn, she says. I work at home, but I commute from my kitchen to my desk in the morning and always go for an hour's walk. I'm always banging the drum for people getting outside. It's a mood lifter. Decorating the house for autumn is really lovely. I'm making soups and crumbles. I love it all. There have been lots of big celebratory moments for Heidi during the last 10 years, but one of her greatest joys has been the connections that she's made with her fans, the Swainettes, as they're known. Some of the biggest highlights are when a reader gets in touch with you, says Heidi. For example, when I wrote a book about a main character who struggled with Christmas, In the story, it was the first year that she felt comfortable enough to start putting up her decorations. And I had somebody get in touch with me who had been bereaved at Christmas. They said, as a result of reading it, they felt that they were able to put up their Christmas decorations too. Knowing that your words have helped somebody is wonderful. While her books are what would typically be described as romances, recently Heidi has been referring to them as love stories. Of course, there is a romantic element to her books, but they are a celebration of love in all its forms. I'm really pleased that this year in particular we are starting to see this real shift, says Heidi. People have always been really snobby about the term romance, but it sells in its absolute millions. It's the biggest seller of any genre there is, I believe. And I think at the end of the day, it's because people want to champion love in all its forms. So I've switched recently from saying that I write romance to saying that I write love stories. There is a main romantic thread throughout the books, yes, but you've got the love stories between family and between friends and even between places. I think that's what humans hope for. I think that's what we all hope for. A love story. That article was also by Emily and is again taken from the Norfolk Magazine October 2025 issue.
And to finish this week's supplement, how coffee has moved on from the days of mellow birds. The Liggins family has just acquired a Sage Barista Express for making a proper cup of coffee. My son Harry and my wife Jeanette bought it from Facebook Marketplace for an undisclosed fee. We already had a machine for making posh coffee, so I wasn't thrilled about the idea of yet another appliance taking up space in our little kitchen. But now it's here, I can see why a coffee lover might want a super duper Sage. For starters, it's a thing of beauty. All dials, knobs and shiny chrome. It makes great noises, great smells and, if you do it right, a great cup of coffee. Harry is into coffee in a big way. He worked in a cafe during his university days and had some barista training, and the Sage Barista Express is really his new toy. He also went out and bought the right coffee beans and one or two accessories to make sure he could do the job properly. Harry is particularly proud of his spring-loaded Normcore tamper. And just in case you're not up to speed with coffee-making lingo, a tamper is the thing you use to press the ground coffee into the portafilter. Oh yes, and the portafilter is the thing... Oh, forget it, life's too short. The world has changed, hasn't it? We all love a posh coffee now, and unsurprisingly, Norfolk appears to be particularly good at it. But it goes without saying that hot drinks weren't like this when I were a lad. You might get a milky coffee in a cafe, but that was almost certainly made with instant coffee from a jar. Mellow Birds, anyone? I've just Googled it, and apparently you can still buy Mellow Birds. Wonders will never cease. Back in the day, you could also buy coffee in a brown plastic cup from a vending machine, and it was truly foul. We had one at my first radio station, and when I was on the night shift, I used to have two or three cups. Looking back, I don't think there was much coffee involved in the process, just a little pile of weird powder at the bottom of the cup, to which the machine added some scalding hot water. Don't think I've been the same since, frankly. Harry's favourite coffee shop is probably Strangers on Pottergate in Norwich, and I can see why. The coffee is good, and so is the vibe. On a recent visit, I had a decaf flat white. I go a bit peculiar if I have too much caffeine. And a pastel de nata. No wonder we don't have custard tarts anymore. The Portuguese are world beaters at custard-based pastries. The staff at Strangers are chirpy and super cool. The two male baristas both had striking facial hair and jaunty headgear. I'm guessing a beanie hat, even in the height of summer, is compulsory. The clientele is also interesting, people of all ages and I presume all walks of life. There was a man in the corner with earphones having an animated work conversation with someone on his laptop. A youngish couple who were quite touchy-feely and very much in love. A man with a dog. A a mother and daughter, and another cool guy busily tapping away on his keyboard. Tech features prominently, with everyone chatting away and then checking their socials. So half an hour in strangers is a bit strange, but a lovely way to spend time people watching. This is how we live now. Meanwhile, back in our kitchen, Harry has created a coffee station. The new Sage Barista Express is the centrepiece of this arrangement, but there's also other coffee making paraphernalia, including a little tub for dumping the spent coffee granules. It's called a knock box, apparently. There is more to be said about coffee making, much more, but it's high time I had a little break and a quick cuppa. Please don't laugh, but I don't know how to work the new machine yet. So until Harry gets home, it's going to be a nice cup of tea. Milk and one sugar, since you asked. And that item by Mike Liggins is taken from the Norfolk Magazine October 2025 issue. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views, starting with 100 classic cars show up for annual festival. One of the county's most popular classic car events made a triumphant return to a Norfolk town. Reefham's Classic Car Festival took over the marketplace on Sunday with one of its biggest events to date. Around 100 cars were parked up in the town throughout the day, drawing in hundreds of visitors. Tom Hills, one of the event organisers, said, "We saw a great turnout of cars and really great support from the public." This event tries to show an eclectic mix of vehicles from pre-war to quite modern, and a few fantastic American cars too. And the owners always seem very willing to chat and tell the story of their cars. It's set in the lovely marketplace in Reefham and provides a great background for the cars and easy access to the local cafes and pub. Live music was provided by a ukulele band with a really surprisingly diverse music set who kindly gave up their time for free. So many times you could hear people either saying, "I used to own one of those," or "My dad used to have one of those," as the cars brought back memories, or in some cases, "I wish we could have afforded one of those." This year's event was held in remembrance of Steve Cappell, a long-time organiser who passed away early this year. The event raised money for the East Anglian Air Ambulance and with more than £750 donated on the day. Mr Hills added, "In all, there were 105 cars booked, although, as always happens, there were a few dropouts on the day, but the square was pretty well packed full." The organisers would like to thank the public for supporting the event, the Town Council and the King's Arms for sponsoring it, for the local residents who cooperated by keeping the market square clear for us to hold the event, and especially the owners of the cars for turning up and showing their cars.
Schools across Norfolk have been invited to apply for a magical hands-on learning experience helping children to look after farm animals. Learn About Livestock has reached more than 14,000 young people since it was launched in 2019. For many, it was their first chance to get a close-to-farm animals experience. Applications are now open for March the 16th to 20th next year, when 20 Norfolk schools will get the opportunity to care for ewes and lambs for 1 week, giving pupils of all ages an unforgettable chance to learn about animal husbandry and to engage in food and farming education. Learn About Livestock is open to all types of schools across Norfolk, including primary, secondary and sixth form settings, as well as SEND, Special Educational Needs and Disabilities Schools. The project is organised by the Food and Farming Discovery Trust, FFDT, the Rare Breed Survival Trust, RBST, Chapelfield Three Rivers Vets Partnership, and the Royal Norfolk Agricultural Association. FFDT manager Francis Robertson said, and who manages the programme, it's essential for children to understand the connections between farming, livestock, and the food they consume. And this hands-on experience facilitates that understanding. We consistently receive positive feedback from participating schools and eagerly anticipate extending this enriching experience to more institutions throughout Norfolk. Gail Sprake from the RBST added, "This is the most rewarding project I've ever been involved with. Watching pupils meet the animals for the first time is magical. They remember it for years, and it opens a window into a whole new world." Organisers said schools are provided with everything they need to look after the animals. All that is required is a safe space for a 10 by 15 foot pen. Schools must contribute £250 to take part and must nominate a lead teacher to attend a briefing in February. The application deadline is Friday, November the 7th at 5 p.m. Places are limited, so schools are encouraged to apply early. For details and an application form, visit www.ffdt.co.uk.
Heritage Railway buses hope national recognition for two of the stations on their line will bring a tourism boost. Sheringham Station and Weybourne Station, both on North Norfolk Railway's Poppy Line, have been given Grade 2 listing by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport on the advice of Historic England. More than 150,000 visitors travel on the 5.5 mile Heritage Railway every year, and bosses are hoping the listing will attract even more people. Graham Hookins, North Norfolk Railway General Manager, said, "We are honoured and proud to receive this recognition from Historic England. That the buildings have survived, to now have extra protection afforded by Grade 2 listing, is a tribute to the volunteers and staff that have cared for the structures since the line closed in 1964. Any additional profile is also very welcome, as caring for the buildings, track, structures, locomotives and carriages costs more than £4 million a year. So, anything that helps attract more visitors to support our heritage work is greatly appreciated." The North Norfolk Railway's trains are running at weekends, plus Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, until November the 2nd.
A football club has been nominated for a national award off the back of a mockumentary. The tongue-in-cheek series was created by Wroxham FC and was inspired by Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney's documentary Welcome to Wrexham, which followed the Hollywood stars as they took over the Welsh club. Wroxham's version was built around the claims that Wrexham fans would often confuse the clubs, leading to them receiving hundreds of calls each month. Welcome to Wroxham gave an insight into the characters that help keep the club going, including 78-year-old groundsman Barry Letton, Rachel the barmaid, and even Wroxham's own superhero, Dadpool. It was sponsored by the e-liquid producer Riot Labs, which wanted to use the concept to help non-league football fans quit smoking. The series amassed more than 600,000 views on social media and has now been shortlisted in the Best Non-League Football Club category at the Football Content Awards 2025. Wroxham FC chairman James Blower said, "We at Wroxham FC sat by the sidelines as we watched Wrexham explode from a small non-league team like ourselves to the powerhouse it is now. We're all aware we potentially missed out on Hollywood investment by just one vowel. When Riot Labs approached us, we saw the opportunity to team up and share the powerful stories and characters keeping non-league football alive and kicking, and put us on the map. We're delighted to receive the nomination. The winner will be decided by a public vote, which ends on October the 12th. They will be crowned during a ceremony at Elland Road Stadium in Leeds on November the 20th.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. And of course, if you have a smart tablet or computer or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk, but please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was David Mitchell, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. We look forward to joining you again next Friday, but for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio! Cheerio.